Well, every now and then I have a great idea for a business. And because they're ideas I know will never amount to anything, and because I wouldn't want to quit being a pastor, and they're all too involved to run as a side venture, I'm going to share one of them with you this morning. And if you want to take it and run with it, feel free. It's my gift to budding entrepreneurs among us this morning. Here it is. Imagine offering a service to people where someone registers their desire to get hunted by some secret black book government agency, and my business provides them with a whole bunch of hints and tips for avoiding capture. Then, on an undisclosed day, I commission a team of actors to attempt to bring them in. That's right, you might be sitting at your desk at work, taking your dog for a walk, or picking up a takeaway curry on a Thursday evening, and you'll suddenly get a text that says, "Get out, they know." And you'll just have to drop everything and run, and you'll have to avoid capture for the next 24 hours. And if you do that, you win some ripper prize. I know there might be copyright issues, but I'd love to call it the Jason Bourne experience. You get to be Jason Bourne for 24 hours. I reckon it would be a winner, like an escape room on steroids. And imagine all those men going through midlife crises that would be lining up to prove their spy skills that they knew they had all along. If only I had signed up to the FBI, I would be their top man right now. I mean, who doesn't want to live the life of an international super spy on the run, stashing a go bag somewhere full of cash and fake passports, purchasing a burner phone? Wouldn't you just love to say, "I've got a burner phone"? How good would that be? Bleaching your hair in a service station bathroom, finding some cash-only motel to hide in overnight. It would be a dream come true. I know it would work as a business, so feel free to take it and run with it. Just give me some royalties. We've got this on record now that it was my idea. I know it would work because we have this romanticized vision of being on the run. In all the movies, being on the run seems thrilling and heroic. There's the overwhelming sense that there is something significant about you and everyone wants you. You are the central character. But how many of us would line up as quickly if our lives really were in danger? If we were really on the run for our lives? If those pursuing us were not just hired actors, but agents of vengeance and violence? Over the last few weeks, we've seen that David has been forced to flee from Saul's wrath. And so far, he has sought refuge and hidden behind his friendship with Saul's sons, Jonathan, his marriage to Saul's daughter, Michal, and the old and well-respected priest, Samuel. But last week, we saw that Saul had been frustrated by all these people helping David, and he was finally determined to hunt him down and kill him at any cost. No more Mr. Nice King. He was hell-bent on crushing David. And so David finds himself well and truly on the run. Jonathan, Michal, and Samuel can't help him any longer. David is on his own. On his own, with the might of the king's army bearing down on him. Being on the run for David is no game. It's no escape room. He is isolated, vulnerable, and living in fear for his life. We cannot romanticize David's predicament. He is no Jason Bourne, no Robin Hood, no Captain Jack Sparrow. We get an insight into how being hunted impacts David through the Psalms that he wrote during this time. Psalm 34:19. Many are the afflictions of the righteous. Psalm 52:2-3. Of his evil pursuers, he writes, "Your tongue plots destruction. Like a sharp razor, you worker of deceit. You love evil more than good, and lying more than speaking what is right." Psalm 59:3-6. "For behold, they lie in wait for my life. Fierce men stir up strife against me." Each evening they come back howling like dogs and prowling around the city. Psalm 63:9, he speaks of his predicament. Those who seek to destroy my life. Such was the turmoil of David's situation that he was drawn to write these poetic pleas for help in the midst of his anguish. This is not a fun time for him. David is in turmoil. And we have to remember that, because it's easy to look at the events that we have read about today and maybe sit in judgment over David in the way that he behaves. On the one hand, it seems as though David arrives at the tabernacle in Nob, lies to a priest, makes ungodly demands of the priest before running off to the land of their enemies. But if we hope to see what God is saying to us, we cannot look at these events with a romantic vision of being on the run. This morning we're going to see the distress of God's anointed, the forces that brought this distress upon him, and how God responds to him in his time of need. And as we do, we will discover how we can be confident in the midst of our own trials. Because going through life's trials can feel like we're on the run, feel like the world is out to get us. Sickness, broken relationship, financial hardship, the loss of a loved one. They can all feel like the world is just pressing in around us, like we are oppressed, pursued, everyone bearing down upon us. And so we are people who desperately need to have confidence that we can turn to our God in these times of trial. Well, whichever way you look at it, David's behavior here, it raises some significant questions. Verses 1 to 6 tell of David's first stop on his way as he flees from Saul's wrath. He arrives at the tabernacle in the priestly city of Nob. Here, the priest Ahimelech questions him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" Ahimelech would have known David, known his reputation as a fierce warrior, and so he comes out to him, the text says, trembling. Because he has this guy, this warrior, appear before him all by himself. Maybe David has gone rogue. Maybe he poses some kind of threat to the priest. David responds by flat out lying. "The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, 'Let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you.'" David is claiming to be on a secret mission from the king, even though we've been following along for the last few weeks and we know that he and the king are not on best terms. And in fact, he's at enmity with the king and running away from the king. David is not here on the king's business. He is here because he stands in opposition to the king. When this lie seems to gain traction with Ahimelech, David demands help. He demands food, but the only food on hand is ceremonial bread, known as showbread. These loaves were dedicated to God and only to be eaten by the priests. Yet Ahimelech, believing he is honoring the king of the nation, offers the bread to David and the supposed secret force of king's soldiers that were there with him. On the provision, they were ceremonially clean. David assures the priest that they were all clean, and he takes the bread. Kind of weird behavior from the anointed of God. The biblical narrative doesn't stop here and cast judgment on David. It doesn't tell us whether his actions are holy or not. The text just keeps rolling on. The story just keeps moving. David gets the bread that he needs through deceiving a priest into breaking ceremonial law. Do such passages justify deception? Do such passages devalue God's law? Well, this is where we need to take a step back and understand what's happening in the bigger picture. Saul is the king, but he was a very poor replacement for Israel's true king, Yahweh, God himself. Saul's repeated lack of trust in God, his rejection of the Spirit of God, and his evil actions had led to God's rejection of him. David had been anointed as the future king of Israel. He'd been empowered by the Spirit, and he had rescued Israel from Goliath and countless other enemies. David's success and anointing of the Spirit caused Saul to be very envious of him and eventually seek to execute him. So the true anointed of God was being pursued unto death by the man rejected by God, in an attempt to continue to cling to his illegitimate claim to the throne. David's life was in peril because he was the man that God anointed in Saul's place. The upshot here is that there's more than just a political squabble going on in this situation. David's life being in peril meant that God's purposes were in peril. If Saul wins, if David is killed, then God's nation would suffer under more of Saul's godless regime. God's plan to make Israel a mighty nation through whom he would bless the world would have suffered a significant setback. The question is, does this justify David lying? Does it justify bending ceremonial law? Well, let's look at these two things separately. First, the ceremonial law. David was not a priest. Eating ceremonial showbread was a massive breach of Levitical law. Leviticus 24, verses 6 to 9 explains that each week, 12 loaves of this bread were to be baked and placed before the Lord in the tabernacle as a memorial. And then on the next Sabbath, they were to be taken away, replaced with new breads, and the old breads were to be eaten by the priests. According to the letter of the law, David and Ahimelech are caught in a significant breach. However, we must not just consider the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law and the purposes of God in making this law. Leviticus 24:9 tells us that this bread belongs to Aaron and his sons, who are to eat it in the sanctuary area because it is most holy part of their perpetual share of the food offerings presented to the Lord. In other words, it was both a memorial to God while it sat on the table, but also part of the way in which God's servants, the priests, were sustained for their ministry. It was part of their inheritance. It was part of the way that they were sustained for their role of serving God. So when Ahimelech considers David's need for food, he considers the service that the Lord's anointed needs to be sustained. And since this is what the bread is for, he could make an exception in this time of need. And this is something we need to understand. God's laws were never made to be kept to the detriment of those who worship him. When Jesus and his disciples were walking through a field on the Sabbath and they gleaned some grain for themselves, they crush it and they eat it, the Pharisees accused them of breaking Sabbath law. They harvested, they crushed the grain in order to get food. Jesus replies by citing this very encounter as precedent of the fact that the law existed to serve humanity in their worship of God, not the other way around. Mark 2:27, Jesus says, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." So Ahimelech giving up ceremonial bread for the good of David, the Lord's anointed, falls well within the spirit of the law, even though it might break the letter of the law. Second, David giving false testimony. Ceremonial law might be one thing, but what about the Ten Commandments? Do not bear false witness. Is David giving false witness here? He has been asked what he is doing and concocts a story about being on a secret mission from the king, a blatant lie. In order to understand what's going on here, we must understand why David is lying. I mean, surely he could have just said, "Ahimelech, you know me. You know I worship Yahweh. You've seen evidence of the Holy Spirit in my life, and you know that Saul has been rejected by God. Give me your assistance, because he is seeking my life. And surely a priest of God would have come to the aid of God's anointed. But David's lie is not out of fear, thinking that Ahimelech would only help him if he's convinced that he's on side with the king. David actually lies to spare Ahimelech pain, not himself. In a minute, we'll learn of the presence of a servant of Saul who's kind of lurking in the shadows of this passage. Whether David knew he was there or not is irrelevant. David would have assumed that Saul would eventually learn of his visit to this tabernacle, and if Ahimelech willingly and knowingly helped David on the run from Saul, it would be treason, and he would be judged. So David's lie was to ensure that Ahimelech and the other priests of the tabernacle were given some kind of plausible deniability when they were questioned. What David does here unites him with others who have lied to the authorities in order to spare other people pain, in order to keep God's purposes moving forward. From Moses' family, who lied to spare his life. From Rahab, who lied to protect Jewish spies in Jericho. To Michal, only a couple of chapters ago, who lied to protect David's life. Right through to people in persecuted countries right now who have to lie to protect their brothers and sisters from discovery. All these technically lie, but yet they're acting out of faith. Faith that preserving God's people was God's ultimate will. And so they broke the letter of the law, but they kept the spirit of it. And so here's the deal. Some of you might be here, and you're going through turmoil. And that turmoil is ripping at your heart. You might feel oppressed, like the world is caving in on you on every side. And maybe the last place that you have thought to turn is God. And maybe the reason the last place you think to turn is God is because you think God is just some rigid, inflexible being up in heaven who cares little for you in your suffering and only cares about whether or not you keep the letter of his law. But what we see here is that while God is holy and God does give us laws to live by, those laws are not laws for law's sake. They are given for our good. And they are given so that God's purposes will be worked out in our lives. Now, I'm not saying that this gives us permission just to live however we want and claim some loophole. What I'm saying is that God knows what it is to suffer. God knows the complexity of your situation. God knows your heart and the intent of your will. And he has worked his law for your good. You can come to him in your suffering, in your turmoil, in your time of trial, and find one who will come close to you and bend his heart to lift you up. This is God's ultimate desire, to lift up the heart of the broken. During this season, David wrote Psalm 34, where he declared from his own personal experience, "When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit." This is David. He is the Lord's anointed, but he is broken. He's brokenhearted. His spirit has been crushed. And so God bends his heart towards David and lifts him up in his time of need. The first reason we can be confident of God in the midst of our trials is because God's heart is bent towards his people. He is not some cold and capricious God of stinginess and legalism. He is a God who knows the complexity of our suffering and answers us in the midst of it. The Bible never assumes that its heroes always get everything right. In fact, as far as religious text goes, the Bible is kind of unique in pointing out the flaws of even its best characters. The Bible makes no apologies for the brokenness of its heroes because it wants us to see that all of humanity, no matter how good, no matter how connected to God they are in desperate need of God. So despite all we have seen so far, it's okay for us to reflect on the fact that David acted poorly here. We don't have to find ways to help him weasel out of his failures. But to spend time quibbling over David's morality here, or the morality of his actions, misses the true point of the big story. To scrutinize David here would be like scrutinizing people who hid Jews during the Holocaust. They lied to the authorities, but we don't spend time moralizing about whether their lies were justified, because we would miss the fact that there was a much greater evil than lies told to the SS. There was Hitler and all the other officers who were putting the Jews in harm's way to begin with. Likewise, there's a far greater evil for us to consider here in the story of David. We could keep debating whether or not David's actions were right or wrong, but there is no debate about the evil of his pursuer, King Saul. And the evil actions of Saul are clearly the main reason that David is forced into this situation in the first place. Saul's evil is rippling out into the nation, and it will have devastating effects. David is forced into the situation he is in. Ahimelech is forced into the situation he is in. Not because of David's lie, not because they broke ceremonial law, because the one who should be seeking the best for God's people, the king of the nation, was seeking the life of the Lord's anointed, bringing a fire of pursuit and evil against David with great force. This is why they are in this predicament. And we should see this real evil figure lurking in the shadows around the tabernacle. In verse 7, we're introduced to a character who will play a significant role in next week's passage. Now, a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. Doeg is only mentioned here in this one verse, but it should send a shiver up our spines for a number of reasons. He is there at the tabernacle, detained before the Lord, which probably means it was the Sabbath, and he couldn't travel the next part of his journey, so he waited at the tabernacle for the Sabbath to be over. But all we see of him should send a shiver up our spine. Firstly, he's an Edomite. This means he's a descendant of Esau, known enemies of Israel. Secondly, he's a servant of Saul. And in chapter 19, verse 1, we learn that all of Saul's servants have been informed that Saul wanted David dead. Thirdly, he is the chief of Saul's herdsmen, aka he's a shepherd. He's the chief shepherd. And we know that shepherding was David's thing. So he's kind of like a replacement David. He's an anti-David. And finally, his name means be careful or uneasy. Basically, it conveys the idea of needing to be wary. Doeg the Edomite lurking in the shadows of the tabernacle should send us shiver up our spine. And next week we will find out that shiver is justified. See, on a spiritual level, Saul has lost all his authority and power. God has rejected him. But on a political level, he's still the king. And this means that his servants are still loyal to him. He is still able to bestow honor on people. Saul is a gateway to power for those who wish to get on his good side. Enter a man like Doeg, an outsider, an Edomite who has worked his way up into the kingdom to be chief shepherd. If he provides Saul with information about David, if he is the one who brings down Saul's sworn enemy, what glory would await him? He is eager to make his way in the nation of Israel. He is eager to please King Saul. And so David's life is in peril simply by his presence in this passage. And so Saul's evil is rippling out. If the man with the most power in the nation has his heart set on evil, then all those who wish to impress this king, to serve him faithfully, or to gain power from him, will stoop to evil as well. Doeg's main contribution to the bigger narrative will happen next chapter, and it is shameful. But this introduction here is supposed to remind us of the very real enemy of God's anointed. David is on the run from a tyrant who is corrupting the whole nation in his bloodthirsty pursuit of an innocent man. Over the last few chapters, we've seen that David has had very few friends, and one by one, Saul has rendered each one of them powerless to help David. Ahimelech the priest was his last hope. He is a man who serves Yahweh, and so David hopes that he would honor Yahweh's anointed king over the nation. And he does. In verses 8 and 9, David declares that he needs a weapon. And Ahimelech offers him the sword of Goliath that was being kept in the tabernacle. David gladly accepts the weapon, not only because it's a mighty sword, but because it's a reminder of God being faithful to him. A reminder that the battle he is in belongs to God. And here is where we need to be reminded that the turmoil, suffering, and trials that we face are part of a battle. The world has an enemy who is hell-bent on destroying the work of God, an enemy whose evil ripples out to every part of our lives. This evil enemy launched an attack against God's creation right back in the very beginning. He launched an attack at the very first humans, and ever since, the impact of his evil has been rippling out, infecting all of creation. Our trials and sufferings are like Doeg in this story. They are servants of the evil one, and they should remind us that we have a true enemy. Because in our times of trial, it's really easy to blame God. In our anger, our confusion, our frustration, we shake our fists at God. We might not verbally blame God, but in our hearts, we harbor bitterness towards him, and we keep him at arm's distance. But we need to see that while God is sovereign over everything, and even sovereign over our suffering, he's not the source of our suffering. The evil one is. To direct our anger at God would be fighting the wrong battle. In fact, God is the one we must turn to in our trials. He's the only one who can help us in our time of trials. David finds this out the hard way, because in verses 10 to 15, when he flees from the tabernacle, we see he flees to the Philistines, to Gath, Goliath's hometown. It seems pretty weird that David would run to the Philistines, but we have to ask ourselves, where else is he going to run? The Philistines surround Israel. They are on just about every side. And so David flees from Israel because he's been driven out by the evil pursuit of Saul. He's only got one place to go. And maybe he thinks that if Saul's greatest commander would defect, that maybe it would hold him in good stead. Maybe the king of Gath, this Philistine king, would be happy to receive David and get inside information from him. But when he arrives, he finds out that the Philistines are just as intent on harming him as Saul. They recall the way that David had killed tens of thousands of them and how the Israelites had sung of his victories, and they prepare to take their revenge and bring him before their king. Sensing that he is in danger yet again, David pretends to be a madman, feigning uncontrollable actions and vandalizing their gate, even foaming at the mouth. Upon seeing this, the king of Gath wants nothing to do with him, claiming he already has enough madmen and doesn't need another one. So David is cast out again on his own. And so there's nowhere for David to run. Israel is against him. The Philistines are against him. He has nowhere to run except to his God. Psalm 34 again. The psalm David wrote in this very season. I sought the Lord and he answered me. And he delivered me from all my fears. Those who look at him are radiant and their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. There's no one that can help David. Jonathan, Michal, Samuel, Ahimelech, they're all behind. No one in Israel can help him. The Philistines won't help him. They're only a further threat to him. And so David turns to his God and finds that while he might be all alone, the angel of the Lord encamps by his side and makes his face radiant. I love it. This poor man cried and the Lord heard. And this is the second reason we need to be confident of God in our trials, because he is not the enemy. Our trials are the result of the evil enemy letting his evil ripple out into this world and infect every part of it. God is not the source of our struggle. In fact, he's the only source of our rescue. If you're here this morning, and you are in the midst of suffering and trial, then like David, there's only one place that you can run. With David, you can sing the songs that he wrote in this season. Psalm 63:1. O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. Psalm 59:16-17. But I will sing of your strength. I will sing aloud of your steadfast love in the morning. For you have been to me a fortress and a refuge in my day of distress. O my strength, I will sing praises to you. For you, O God, are my fortress, the God who shows me steadfast love. And Psalm 52:8-9. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the steadfast love of God forever and ever. I will thank you forever because you have done it. I will wait for your name, for it is good in the presence of the godly. Isn't it awesome that we have the outpouring of David's heart in this moment? We have the story here in 1 Samuel, but we have the songs that he wrote to give us a real insight into his emotion and affection during this time. The second reason we can be confident of God in our trials is because he is not our enemy. He is our only refuge, our only high tower, our only strength. He is our only hope in our time of struggle. I know that turning to God when it feels like the whole world is falling in on you is hard. I know that it often feels like God has abandoned you when you go through these times. I know that it's so much easier just to blame God and want nothing to do with him. It gives us someone to be angry at. It gives us someone to blame. But I also know that turning to God in the midst of our trials is the only way to find hope. Here we've seen David, the Lord's anointed, the one who had been promised the kingdom, being driven out of the kingdom. It would have been easy for him to doubt God's promises, to feel as though God had rejected him. But some of his most faithful and beautiful songs were written to God at this very time. At the time he would have been forgiven for being angry with God. David seems to be more in awe of God. And our Lord Jesus Christ was no different. Jesus suffered so much at the hands of the rippling evil of God's enemy. He was wrongfully arrested, wrongfully mocked, beaten, and scorned. He was wrongfully sentenced to death. He was wrongfully banished from Jerusalem. He was wrongfully nailed to a cross to die. And in our place, on that cross, the punishment against sin that was not his was unjustly poured out on him. and he suffered the judgment that we deserved. But right here on that cross, in this tragic and brutal moment of suffering, it was to the Psalms of David that Jesus turned. It was here that the Psalms of David were fulfilled. Psalm 34 again. This is the psalm that David wrote when he was kicked out of the Philistine city of Gath. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. Affliction will slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. When the soldiers come to break Jesus' legs and end his life, they find that he has already died. And so they left his legs unbroken. And the text tells us they did it to fulfill this very psalm. And when we see our Lord Jesus, with the suffering of the whole world bearing down to him, turn to his Father in song. Surely we can see that our God is the only place we should turn in our trial. See, it's not just the non-broken bones of Jesus that are fulfilled in this psalm. The righteous will not be condemned. Jesus is bearing the sin of humanity, and the righteous Jesus is not condemned. The Lord redeems the life of his servants. Jesus' life is redeemed when he's risen from the dead on the third day. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. What does he say to the thief who takes refuge in him on those dying moments? Today you will be with me in paradise. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. There is suffering and brokenness in this world, and it ripples out, it impacts our lives, and it feels like rubbish. It feels like trash. It crushes us, and it feels like we are pursued. It feels like the walls are just pressing in on every side. But God is not our enemy in these moments. He's our only refuge. He is the only refuge who promises that we will not be condemned if we put our faith in him. Rosalie Church, this morning, wherever you are at, whatever level of suffering is bearing down on you right now, can I plead with you? God's heart is bent towards the brokenhearted. His heart is bent towards you in love. And he is not your enemy. He is your only hope, your only refuge in this time of trial. So cast yourself upon him as David did to his God and find him faithful over and over again. Let's pray together.